And what a pleasure to be back again, 2 years in a row. You know, by the way, I've got, who remembers a year ago the huge scale of truth that was sitting up in front? Cool. So, I mean, if you're ever listening to a sermon or a speaker or a seminar, and you even come away with just one thing that you can remember and share, I think it's been well spent time. And I noticed in the bulletin, Pastor said, the reason I'm here is to help you all, us, defend creation against the world's philosophies. There is an incredible suppression of truth in the world around us. The kind of stuff you're going to hear this morning and throughout today won't even get heard by 99% of people in Christian churches, let alone the world around us. So hopefully you'll come away with yet something you can share and make a difference in people's lives. Because God wants the truth to be known, and he's literally angered when the truth is suppressed. You Google truth in the Bible, and it comes up thousands of times. It's a central, from cover to cover issue in the Bible. Just a couple quick resources that cost absolutely nothing. Those of you who signed up for my newsletter last year, you got one that I think is just phenomenally impactful. I was able to go to a fossil bed out in Idaho. All the textbooks say those rock layers are 16 million years old. And in this one particular location, there are millions, if not billions, of fossilized leaves. Now, when you break open the shale, they still have color. They still smell like rotted leaves. And when they did DNA analysis, how much DNA is left in these 16 million-year-old leaves? They know how fast the DNA disappears. They found out there's the amount of DNA left that you would expect if those leaves had been in the ground and had been buried about 4,500 years ago. Now, what happened here on Earth about 4,500 years ago? The flood of Noah ripped up everything, buried billions of leaves in this location. So, and that's just one of the articles in this newsletter. So it's a great way of just having neat conversation items with other people. The second free resource, I hope I'll have time for at the end of this presentation. If not, I'll mention it tonight. But the topic for Sunday school is I've got this pagan, non-Christian, non-believing father, Native American, sharing with his son about what is truth, what is reality, what is morality. He's just training his son how to think. That's what our schools do. That's what our movies do. That's what the world system around us does, is train the next generation what's the truth and how to believe, what to believe. Now, the Bible makes a very, very clear command to every Christian in Psalm 145, verse 4. This is our job as adults. It says, one generation shall praise thy works to another. They shall declare thy mighty acts. Think about how our world would be like if we did nothing else but as adults in our museums, in our schools, in our universities, in our conversations, we shared the mighty acts of God as if they were really true. What are the mighty acts of God? Well, first, they are creation. Everything didn't make itself. God literally, supernaturally performed miracles of unfathomable magnitude as he brought all the energy and space and everything into existence in the universe. And then death is here because we brought it into creation. God made not just a good creation, a very good creation with no death. But if there'd been no death, when we sinned, we would be forever separated from him. So because of our actions, death was brought into creation so we would not live forever separated from God. And there was a dividing moment in all of world history. There was a world that existed before the entire world was deluged and destroyed. Everything was ripped up, buried, pulverized, and there's more animals extinct than there are alive today because of that flood. But humanity survived through it, and then they spread out across the globe afterwards. Now, those are mighty acts of God that really happened. They are real history, ignored by the world around us. We as Christians have got to teach God's word as if it's true. And I know this church knows it, but look for opportunities to teach it. And what I'm going to share this morning is one of those opportunities. And then the mightiest act of God is what I think, as we should as a church, spend the most time on, and that's the God of the universe who made it all and knows every one of us and knew us before the foundations of the universe were built. He knew we would exist. Before he made the first atom, he had us in mind. He knows all of history in advance. He became a human being, took that penalty of death upon himself. It's why death exists. He knew he would come and be the sacrifice in our place and became a human being. So those are the mighty acts of God, the big, huge items. Every one of us experience mighty acts of God in our life every day. And we're to share those too. But these are the big ones. Now, you would think, because those are real, because people spread out after the flood, they would remember those things. You understand, Adam walked with God in the garden. God shared how creation happened, I suspect. Doesn't say so, but it's just the natural thing. Adam would have said, where'd everything come from? God would have told him. You realize God's word tells us that Adam's son Seth overlapped with Noah's life of 100 years. Seth, the son of Adam, knew Noah. He would have told him these things. Noah would have brought that information on the ark. He would have shared it with his sons. It would have been known by the people who came off the ark and spread out around the earth these mighty acts of God. Everyone on earth is closely related. If you look at a biblical timeline, if you read the Bible like any other book, you're going to come to the conclusion that there were 10 generations from Adam to Noah. There's about 10 generations from Abraham to Jesus. And then generations have shortened from hundreds of years to only about 20 years. But in spite of it, in the 6,000 years of earth history since creation, there have only been somewhere in the range of 150 to 200 generations. In all of history, we're all very closely related. And as these cultures spread out since the flood, 4,500-ish years, there should be a remembrance of the flood. And there should be a remembrance, at least of bits and pieces, of these other mighty acts of God. Not just in the Bible, who gives us a clear, straightforward, understandable, in crystal clear language, account of it all. But it gets distorted with time if you don't have God's word preserved. But there should still be remembrances. And that's what we're going to talk about. You see, the impetus for this lecture was about 10 years ago, I was invited to a world history class because the students were told to prepare a presentation on where did we come from? What is Earth's history? Where did everything originate? And they said, now go just look at different cultures and different things in the world and come up with ideas and give a presentation. Well, one student group came and gave the presentation about evolution. That's where everything came from. Another presentation was about the Hindu idea that the earth was made on the back of a huge elephant, and that's why it exists. Another group talked about aliens, where life is here because aliens brought it. Well, one group, the head of it was a Christian. She'd heard one of my presentations. She asked the teacher, can we give half of our half hour to a speaker who will come in and talk about the evidence for creation? We're here because we were created by God. So I had 15 minutes to talk to a high school world history class and try to change their mind about where they came from. And they've had 18 years of indoctrination that evolution made them. Now, anything I tell them, they're going to hear far more that contradicts it. But a friend had sent me a book talking about an ancient American Delaware Indian account of creation. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to go a different direction as I try to help these kids understand the Bible means what it says. Instead of starting there, I'm going to go through the back door and get back to there. Now remember, this is a public school class. Now, as I started, we had about 30 kids, top dogs in their high school, okay? They know it all. And they are bored, and they are skeptical. And I stand up to talk about biblical creation, and they're slouched way down in their seats, and their arms are folded, and they're just kind of staring at me. Okay? That's my audience. Now, first of all, I just took 15 seconds and said, you know, world history is important because what we're told about the past determines about what we believe about the present. What we believe about why people act the way they do determines what we think is right or wrong. So this is really an important subject. But we're going to talk about creation by talking about what the Native Americans believed about creation, because it's kind of interesting. And by the way, the girl who went ahead of me had spent her 15 minutes basically reading through selected parts of Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and then passing out, as a kind of a cutesy activity, coloring book pages of Adam and Eve. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, she just made the Bible look like a coloring book. And I'm going to overcome that now, too. So I said, you know, they're the original Native American tribe were the ancestors of what we call the Delaware Indians. They were originally the most powerful Indian tribe, or you're supposed to say Native American, but everybody can think understands, Native American tribe in North America. They were widely acknowledged as what's called the grandfather tribe. They themselves say they are the root of all the other tribes. They call themselves the Lenni Lenape, which means the original people. Okay, that's their name for themselves. And it's pretty much known, based on their records and accounts, that they migrated into North America through the Pacific Northwest, coming down through Alaska, the Bering Straits, probably during the Ice Age when the water levels were lowered, over from Western Europe, and then down into America, and then they spread out. And from them sprung the Cherokees and the Hopis and the Pawnees and all these other Indian tribes, but they called themselves the original. They're also kind of meticulous record keepers, kind of like the Israelites were meticulous about recording ancestral history. These guys were too. And their book was called the Wollum Olam. By the way, this is the name of the book. Now, it's been published clear back in the 1800s as the Red Record because Indians were called red men. They have more pigment in their skin and more of a red cast. The subtitle is The Oldest Native American History. And at the top, you can't quite read it, but it says the Red Record or the Wollum Olam. So that's the name of their account. But it was like hieroglyphics. They didn't have letters like we have letters. They had pictures like the Egyptians had pictures, which is interesting because the Egyptian is essentially the oldest human writing, and they used pictures. Okay? Well, these guys also, who would have come from the Tower of Babel, the Egyptians broke off, the Chinese broke off, they broke off. They had a similar sort of pictorial language. Now, in 1815, we were starting to have universities in America. There was one in the Kentucky Territory. It wasn't a state yet. It's called Transylvania University. And there was a linguistics Frenchman who was a genius at linguistics, very interested in historical things, and he taught there. Well, this all comes out of this book, by the way, which has like been republished and republished, and this is a 1970 republication of the original book. And it tells where this stuff comes from. There was a doctor named Dr. Ward. He was actually traveling through the Indiana Territory and came upon a tribe of Indians who were dying of some disease, and he didn't even say what it was, but they were just dying one after another, a pandemic in their tribe. Well, he stayed with them for months, nursed enough of them back to health that they survived, and out of gratitude, they gave him their most valuable possession, which was a set of writings on birch bark. Birch bark's high oil content. They made canoes out of it. It will last for dozens of years or even centuries if protected, and then it would be recopied. He didn't know what to do with it. It's just a bunch of pictures. He passed it on to this linguist who spent the next 30 years talking to Moravian monks who'd been in America in the 1600s and going to tribes and trying to find people who could translate. And he produced a book in the 1840s, died in the 1850s, all his original records disappeared. The book was republished in the late 1800s, republished again in the 1900s, republished again with additions in the 1970s. That's what this book is. That's where the information comes from. Now, what this record shows, he had to connect pictures with words, because the stuff in here predates Christian writings. It predates the Bible, which was written by Moses about 3,000 years ago. There's stuff in this document that had to have been known earlier than that, much closer to the flood, by eyewitness accounts. Talks about the origin of the universe, the origin of humanity, the origin of evil and death. Talks about a huge flood event. Talks about the dispersion of humanity. Carved on birch bark, it has key concepts by pictures, and they were just sung around a campfire to pass history on to the next generation, these mighty acts of history. This is what it's a picture of an early replication of what was in this book that was published in the 1850s. So each one of these columns, you see these symbols, is like a chapter in a book of history. And then the next column's another chapter, and the next column's another chapter. Now what I'm going to do for the next 15 minutes is walk you through it, because what I saw was I started to walk through this Red Record book. It literally stunned me, because I'd never seen anything like this. It's absolutely stunning, the information that was contained here. So I'm just going to start with chapter one. There's a symbol, kind of a dome. Three words were attached to it, okay, the meaning of what this was. And then we have the English meaning of what those words were, what the concepts they contain. So that first symbol means, at the beginning, the sea everywhere covered the earth. Okay? Second symbol, above all this water, this swirling cloud extended within it, the Great Spirit moved. So the Spirit's going to do something. What are the characteristics of this Spirit? He's primordial. That means he's before time. Before time existed, he existed. He's everlasting. He's beyond time. He'll always be there. He always was there. He's invisible. We can't see the Spirit. And he's present everywhere at the same time. Those are the characteristics of the one who's above the waters. And he moved, meaning he did something. What's he do? He brings forth sky and then earth. He brings forth clouds and then the heavens. He brings forth day and then night. Then he brings forth the stars. And he brings forth all these things to move in harmony. And then, stirred to action, strong winds blew, and clearing the sky in rapid streams. Anybody notice anything familiar about this? The order of it all? At the end of each chapter, I'm going to summarize. And then as pure as snow, the land rose to be inhabited. So there's water everywhere, and then the water is separated from the land. So here's what's going on. You've got a God who creates things from water. His character is, he exists before time, he's eternal, he's a spirit, and he's present everywhere. What's he do? He makes day and then night. He makes earth and then sky. Later, he makes the stars, not at the very beginning. He separates sky from earth, and he separates land from water. Sounds like we're walking through Genesis, doesn't it? Same concept. Now, it's not the Bible. Remember, generation after generation after generation after generation, dozens and dozens of generations, maybe hundreds, are separating this from the original events of the Bible. So there's going to be variations and distortions. But the parallel is stunning. Here's a culture separated by 10,000 miles from Moses and 1,000 years prior to Moses writing the Bible. And they've written down and carried on with stunning accuracy the same concepts. So what's this Great Spirit do next? This Great Spirit, this God, created creator spirits. I'm just speculating that's angels, okay? And he makes living beings, immortals, with souls. Souls are something that will live beyond our physical life. And then the ancestor, the grandfather of man, gave the first mother, the mother of life. Now, I don't know what all that's about. We'll just skip past it. Remember, it's not the Bible. But I find this really significant. He made fish, he made turtles, he made beasts, he made birds. He made very specific different kinds of animals. But a bad spirit brought forth bad creatures, snakes and monsters. Now, these Indians, they blame bad stuff on Satan, in essence, instead of taking responsibility that mankind's really the one who brought it upon ourselves by obeying Satan. But a bad spirit brings bad stuff. And then the worst thing people running around basically naked in the forest can think of, this bad spirit makes flies and mosquitoes. Nasty stuff. So God creates life. He gives people with souls. They're meant to live forever. Animals are named, very distinct, different types. There's a bad spirit present in this creation, and the bad spirit's responsible for bad things in their view. We'll keep walking through it. Friends, now here's the original creation. Friends were all living things with each other. You get no hint of any sort of death happening. Everything's friends. Then the benefactor, the helpful spirits, were busy. That's probably the angels. And these ancestors, the first men, they were alone, so women were brought to them. Adam was made first, Eve was made second. Hungry for the first food, the ancestors gathered it. They didn't eat animals. They only ate plants because there was no death. And all was delightful, all was carefree, all was happy. And then secretly at the end, an evil snake, a sorcerer, came to earth. Now this is really interesting because every pagan ancient culture worships snakes. The Aborigines, they worship snakes. The Africans, they worship snakes. The ancient Chinese, they worship snakes. The Greeks, Athena had a big snake on her shield. Why do snakes keep showing up in all these ancient pagan reject God cultures? Because in the view of sinful man, God is the one who set all these progressive rules. We got to follow his rules. And who brought freedom from the rules? What does Satan say? You can be as God. In other words, make your own rules. And it's interesting, all these ancient cultures, they worship snake, the snake. It's that remembrance of who Satan came disguising himself as. And that representation just continues. And there's that knowledge right there in that early document. And because of that, because we followed Satan instead of God, because of this evil, wickedness, wrongfulness, criminal acts came, and black weather came, and sickness came, and death came. There was an event that caused all that. It's right there in this document, too. And all of this was long ago in a land beyond the great flood. This was the first world that existed. That flood is the demarcation mark of all history. You leave the flood out, you misinterpret everything about the past. You misinterpret the rock layers. You misinterpret the age of things. You misinterpret the fossils. You misinterpret the very nature of God and the responsibility of humanity for why death exists if you leave that flood out. Summarizing, evil enters creation. It's why it's here. It's why death is here. Everything was in harmony. Man came first. Woman came second. We were tempted by this snake. Mankind became sinful and death started. And there's a flood coming. I'm going to keep walking you through this document. By the way, about now, because I'm just not talking about the Bible, which kids are programmed as just a bunch of religion, and because I'm not talking about, you know, just attacking their heartfelt beliefs on evolution, instead of sitting there slouched down and skeptical, I notice they're now, you know, sitting up and kind of curious and interested in listening. But I'm running out of time. And I said to the teacher, because I knew I was coming up on my 15-minute limit, I said, you know, I could just wrap up in the next few minutes because I know I'm running out of time. And she said, you know what? You just take the next half hour for the next group and we'll do theirs tomorrow and you can have the rest of the class. Isn't that cool? God just provides. So I was able to kind of walk through it and take my time. Next chapter. Long ago in the time of the mighty serpent, there were evil beings. There were. There was all sorts of demons at this point. A third of the angels of Satan was cast out of heaven, and they were influencing humanity. And the mighty serpent was an enemy to the ancestors, who soon grew to hate it. And they both fought, and they did wrong, and there was no peace. So there's all sorts of evil going on as time passes in creation. And homes were destroyed by murders and bloodshed. And the mighty serpent resolved that men and living things would be destroyed. Now here again, they got it wrong. The flood was a judgment by God upon the sinfulness of mankind, because God judges evil, or he's not a just God. And if you don't see it happening right now to evil people, the Bible says, leave the justice unto the Lord. It's not our job to find retribution. In the end, it will come, because all of us are going to face him when we die. But God brought judgment. It's blamed on the serpent here. What's this judgment? He brought sea monsters and a snaking flood. And nowhere else in this whole book, and by the way, what I'm showing you is just like less than 10% of the whole Wollum Olam document. It goes on to name kings and battles and migration across North America to where they ended up in the Delaware area, which is why they're called the Delaware Indians. But this ancient history is so old, there's only a slight, small section describing it. But nowhere else is there this emphasis. I mean, just listen to how they're describing the flood of Noah. Flooding and flooding, filling and filling, smashing and smashing, drowning and drowning. Total devastation. This isn't just some little, oh, the water came up and went down. Total destruction of the globe covering the entire earth. That's the flood that they're describing. And what happens? There's a single hero. At Turtle Island, Ninnibush, the great hare. And by the way, he's called the hare and the turtle. Turtles are considered wise and long-living. Hares, what's their kind of main characteristics, we think? Nothing breeds like a hare. They have lots of offspring. So this grandfather of humanity had lots of offspring. He's called the great hare. He's the grandfather of life. He's the grandfather to all humanity, and he was. Steadily creeping, the turtle went to the rescue, this man. So all men are evil. There's lots of evil all over the earth. There's violence everywhere. A flood comes, and one man saves life, humanity, and becomes the ancestor to all humans. Living things and people went forth through rapids and shallows, struggling to where the turtle was. Now, remember, this is Native Americans passing along a great epic to their children. So they're making this great epic story out of it. He struggles through the streams, and they struggle to be where he is, and there's sea monsters, and people were eaten. And the spirit daughter helped with the boat. They're attributing the salvation not just to Noah, but to spiritual help. And from here and there, one came to help them all. So there's something coming two at a time. He was, in their language, he was called Ninnibush. Ninnibush, Ninnibush, grandfather of all, ancient grandfather, turtle grandfather. The people were here, and they were there. They were united. They were frightened. They prayed, and they were saved, and the world was restored. And the flood dried out, and the valleys and hollows. I don't know. In a way, what's it say in the book of Psalms? The valleys sank down, and the mountains rose up, and the water returned from whence it came. That was the end of the flood, according to Psalms. Similar kind of concepts. And the great peril was over, it was over. Summary of that chapter. You've got a hero ancestor. He saves the people. He survived in some sort of boat. There's a reference to two things coming at a time. He's the ancestor to all people, and the flood ends. Now, this document, if you just Google the Red Record. And by the way, Google, Facebook, Instagram, they're all managed and controlled. Information that doesn't agree with the people running it, they don't allow it on there. You got to realize that. Kids, realize when you go onto the computer and get information, you're only getting the information you're allowed to be seeing. And anything that disagrees is increasingly being censored and kept off. So you'll see, oh, this document's just a fake and a forgery. Well, some early Christians just decided to promote Christianity by creating this document in the 1800s. What I come to next is absolutely convinced me there's no way this document's a forgery, because nobody creating a forgery would ever have put in this document what we're about to see next, because it makes no sense whatsoever, especially in the 1800s. This is what happened after the flood. The Lenape, the true people, the turtle people, they were crowded together. They were living in cave shelters. Remember, Noah landed. The world is like a mud flat. Vegetation's just regrowing. Trees are just regrowing. And there's an ice age raging, and I'm going to get back to that at the very end. Their homes were icy. Their homes were snowy. Their homes were windy. Their home was freezing. So, to the North Slope, to have less cold, the big game herds went. Now think about what this document just said. Think about you're living in Wisconsin, and it's cold in the winter, except during the ice age, it's cold all year long. And you want to get warmer, you don't go to Florida, you head to Upper Canada so it'll be warmer. And the animals are all heading to Canada because it's warmer. Does that make any sense at all? Doesn't. It's absurd. If you're making a document to try to convince people this is a true document, why would you put something totally absurd in there in the 1800s? By the way, nobody had ever proposed or even considered the possibility that there had been an ice age in the earth until 1850, after this document was published by this linguist. So he wouldn't have put that in there either because he didn't even know about an ice age. It wasn't even proposed scientifically until after this document. Now the herds have went north where it's warmer. To be strong, to be rich, the travelers from the builders, the hunters, broke away. Where on earth was everybody gathered together building a big building project? Tower of Babel. I heard someone just say that. After the flood. And then groups broke off. And this group, by the way, and this is normal human nature, they're pounding their chest saying, the strongest of all, the holiest of all, the best of all, the hunters are. So the hunters are the best of the ones that broke off. Of course they were. They're writing about themselves. To the northeast, south, and west, the hunters and explorers went. So humanity just dispersed across the globe. And this is one group of them, the Delaware Indians. And this is their document of all history. So we have an introduction to the Ice Age. People lived in caves. The Age of Ice began. The travelers left the builders. Animals migrated north where it was warmer. And people became hunters and explorers, heading out in every direction. And then the document goes on, and it talks about, as I said, they migrated across the Pacific Northwest, and it talks about their various, you know, chiefs and rulers and battles with other people and so on. And to me, the rest of the book did get kind of boring, but this was just fascinating. You see, they've just walked us through Genesis chapter 1 through chapter 11 in stunning, remarkable parallel concepts. Now, I'm going to get back to why this even matters in a second, but it really does. The significance is profound and important. But I want to talk about the Ice Age. Before I do that, I'll just talk about the flood in general. Remember I said this flood is a demarcation of all human history, and every people group on the planet has a record of it. You won't find this promoted or advertised on Google. They haven't quite deleted all the evidence, because if you Google flood stories, flood accounts, you could come up with lists of anywhere from 150 to 250 cultures that have accounts of the flood. Now, they're very distorted. They're very much presented as stories. If you go to Alaska, they've got a story of an Alaskan who was on an iceberg, and he brought with him various animals, and he landed in, you know, up there in the frozen north, and created the culture of humanity. So they've got a person on a floating vessel with animals. Other cultures will talk about it being a judgment of God. Almost all of the 200 plus stories, it's a judgment of God. Some of them talk about a rainbow afterwards. Some of them talk about other kind of floating vessels. Many of them talk about bringing animals. But almost all of them talk about a universal judgment, and all of them describe it as a water event. Why didn't the Eskimos say, oh, humanity was frozen and out of existence? Because they're remembering the real event. How come the people living in Saudi Arabia don't say that, look, God sent a huge drought and wiped out humanity? Because they don't ever see floods, because they remember the real event. And it got increasingly distorted, but they know it happened. So that record of that biblical event is pervasive across humanity because it's real. And yet if you leave it out, you misinterpret all of history. You misinterpret geology, you misinterpret biology, you misinterpret genetics, you misinterpret everything because you think it's just went on for millions of years. Why was there an ice age? There have been a dozen, and there still are, there's a dozen different raging in academia explanations for the ice age. And they say there's been a dozen or more ice ages. And there are various misinterpretations of the ice cores that explain that. They don't explain it. They're just interpretations based on the idea that there couldn't have been a worldwide flood. But the problem is, why are there a dozen? When you have a whole bunch of different theories and people are arguing about it, you know what that means? It means none of them work. All of them have problems that can't be explained. And that's why there's so many. That's why it's not a theory or a fact of science. It's just an idea. It's a story. The problem is, to get an ice age, you have to evaporate trillions and trillions of gallons of water out of the ocean, because you're going to lock up all that water as ice. During the ice age, the oceans of the world were lowered somewhere between 200 and 400 feet. We're going to destroy the planet, global warming, climate change fervor is about the idea that we're going to warm things up a couple degrees and the ocean levels may rise a couple feet. Yet in the past, we've seen the oceans drop and then rise again 200 to 400 feet. To evaporate that amount of water, you have to have trillions of BTUs of energy and heat being poured into the ocean. We can't explain where that came from if we leave the flood out. You see, because the fountains of the deep broke, we can see a split on the Earth. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge goes all the way from the South Pole to the North Pole, down around Argentina, up through California, all the way to Alaska. The whole Earth has been split open with unimaginable amount of lava, 10,000 degrees, pouring out, creating new ocean basins, probably vaporizing water at supersonic speed, shooting up in the atmosphere for 40 days and 40 nights, coming down as rain when it condenses. That's probably where that rain came from. But all of that lava in the land, the continents themselves were being pushed apart rapidly. Almost all creation scientists believe this is true. They look at the data and those continents have moved. And everything is being pulverized, is being laid down as huge layers of rock covering the entire Earth, formed underwater. While those continents are moving into new positions, India is slamming into Asia, shoving up the Himalaya Mountains. You hear the kind of things I'm describing? That's the picture of a global biblical flood, generating enormous amounts of heat. The Arctic Ocean was probably 70 degrees, like the Bahamas at the end of this flood. Rapid continental movement, mass extinctions are happening, and you're spread, widespread deposition of sedimentary rocks are forming, all during this one-year period. Massive Earth geological changes, most of them heating up the oceans of the world. So at the end of the flood, those oceans across the Earth, and they're enormous in their amount of their volume, it would take centuries for those oceans to cool back down. They're heating up. This would have guaranteed an ice age on this planet, because that warm water is evaporating orders of magnitude faster than we see it today, because it's so much warmer. All weather patterns are driven by ocean water temperature. Much warmer oceans, much more evaporation. You have cloud cover around the Earth, which is reflecting much more of the sunlight away from the Earth. So Earth temperatures are lower. And that evaporation has to go somewhere. It's going to come down as snow to the north and to the south. So you're going to have snow building up in Canada. And it's believed those glaciers that built up were 10 miles thick. 10 miles of a glacier that thick has so much weight, it shoves it forward, carves out the Great Lakes, leaves all sorts of rubble fields, which we know are caused by glacier movement. And it takes 10 inches of snow to make an inch of ice. So we're talking about 100 miles of snow. So the snow in Canada tomorrow after the flood, the forecast would have been snow. Next week, snow. Next month, snow. Next year, snow, 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 more snow. And that's what's going on. Now, keep following what's happening. All that increased water evaporation, cloudy skies, centuries of snow, It's the evaporation that's sucking heat out of the ocean. So the oceans are cooling and cooling and cooling. Now let's think about what's happening worldwide in the bigger picture. You see, that snow is collecting in the Siberian Canada tundra, but near the ocean, up along Siberia near the ocean, up along Alaska near the ocean, up along Canada near the oceans are 70 degrees, and 100 years later, maybe they're 60 degrees, and 100 years later, 50 degrees, and 100 years later, 40 degrees. You have an almost tropical environment for maybe tens to hundreds of miles inland from this very warm ocean. The snow is collecting further south, but it's very warm further north. By the way, we find mastodons with semi-tropical vegetation in their stomachs, and they lived all over Siberia. And you could, mastodons have a new generation every year. So within 500 years, you could have millions of mastodons roaming around in Upper Siberia. They're not going to live in the ice fields. They're going to live closer, within a few hundred miles of the ocean shore, where you get a little microclimate from the warm ocean water. And it's going to be very warm for many, many centuries, slowly cooling, cooling, cooling. Well, as you have these millions of mastodons roaming, you never had ice in Israel. You never had ice in Saudi Arabia. The equatorial regions, they had more waterfall. And that's exactly what we find. You remember when Moses sent the spies into Israel, you know, Caleb and Joshua and eight others filled with giants and humanity that were threatening? Remember they came back with a bunch of grapes so big they had to have it on pole between two men. You know, huge variety of grapes that we apparently don't even have anymore. But it was called the land flowing with milk and honey. If you go to Israel today, without irrigation, it's a desert wasteland. Nobody would want to live there. Before Israel took it over in 1948, it was just a bunch of Arab nomads. They didn't even want the land for the most part. It was just worthless, a dry wasteland. Why was it the land flowing with milk and honey? Because there was lots of water from 4,500 to 3,500 years ago. Lots more rainfall. But once those oceans cooled, they cool down and cool down and cool down and cool down. I am told that the up off of Maine, the big bay, Hudson Bay up there, huge area of salty ocean water. Water that contains salt will go sub-freezing below 32 degrees, 30, 39, 28 degrees, below the freezing point, and at some point it will crystallize. And you can freeze hundreds of square miles of the Hudson Bay overnight. It'll just like, ice will shoot across the bay because it goes sub-freezing. I think that's what happened. I think you had these millions of mammoths roaming around. It's getting colder. Their environment is shrinking. The ocean water is dropping, dropping, dropping. At some point, the oceans froze and stayed frozen. They've got ice sheets to the south of them. Now they have a frozen ocean water to the north of them. Now air temperatures drop dramatically and rapidly, and they got trapped. And we find millions of mammoths frozen in the north that haven't decayed because the temperature dropped so fast. Within a matter of days and weeks, it was well below freezing temperatures, and they simply froze. Now see, that explains it. It explains the mammoths, it explains why they're there, it explains the subtropical vegetation. It explains why people would follow great game herds north where it would be warmer. But nobody in the academic world can explain it. All the evidence fits a biblical event. Now, I'm going to just jump past this. If you look at a map of the extent of ice during the Ice Age, this is that map. You'll notice here's the ice sheets in Europe. This area, when there's no difference in elevation, it's not like there's a mountain range blocking anything, this area was never covered with ice. It never had great ice sheets. The ocean just eventually froze, and all those animals are now permanently stuck in a frozen muck, but not necessarily in huge sheets of ice. Now, the ice spread out beyond the coast here, but the same thing with Alaska. These areas along the coast were never covered with sheets of ice. Last little topic. How am I doing on time? I'm going to take just 5 more minutes and go a little bit over. These sheets of ice did not take millions of years to form. Every textbook will say when they do ice cores, and sometimes they're 10 miles deep of ice in these thick sheets of ice in northern Europe and up in the Arctic. And they'll look at the cores and they'll see these lines and they'll say each line might represent a 100-year period or a year period. They probably represented a snowstorm and a break between snowstorms. They say it took hundreds of thousands of years to make these sheets of ice, each different era. And then there's been multiple ice ages. Let me give you a story. In World War II, they had these P-38, I believe, airplanes. And they left a base in Greenland, were flying across Greenland. They hit a snowstorm and they were forced down onto a glacier in Greenland. And because they couldn't fly, and the snowstorm just lasted for days, they had to leave their airplanes, and they actually trekked out and made it to another air base along the coast, but they left the airplanes. Well, there were some that was 1944. There were some businessmen in Tennessee. They read about this in 1974, 44, 54, 64, 74, 30 years later, and they thought, you know, those planes are still up there. Let's just go up there and dust the snow off their wings and fly them home. So they spent the next 10 years searching for them, you know, because there's been lots more snowstorms, and they knew they'd be buried, but they didn't know how deep. Well, after 10 years and millions of dollars of efforts, they succeeded in bringing one of those airplanes home. And by the way, this was a cover in Time magazine in about 2005. And I don't think anybody realized the significance, but I did. And it's now been in different creation magazines and such. It took them millions of dollars in 10 years because piece by piece, they had to bring one of those airplanes from underneath 250 foot of ice. In 30 years, 250 foot of ice had formed. And that wasn't during an ice age. You know, that means there was 2,500 feet of snow that drifted or blew or landed in that area. 2,500 feet of snow in 30 years. See, they had steam generators and dig this tunnel 250 foot down and then melt out a chamber around that plane and then bring it up piece by piece in order to get it out of there. So this idea that ice sheets have taken millions or hundreds of thousands of years to form, it's nonsense. We know it's not true. We've got that evidence to show how fast glaciers can form. So you see how everything fits together? Now here's the problem, the wrap-up. Whenever the belief in evolution increases and it becomes a fact in people's minds, and it's all just storytelling and interpretation, it's not fact, it's misinterpretation of biology, it's misinterpretation of geology, it's misinterpretation of history, because you've left the mighty acts of God out, then the belief in the Bible decreases, and Christianity shrinks, and its influence on culture shrinks. Now here's where I wrap up. And I told the students this. I said, suppose you're driving home, and by the way, by the end, they're leaning forward. I didn't force a book on them. They all took one of my books. I think there's going to be kids in heaven someday because I connected the Bible with history for them. And it made it relevant. But I said, suppose you're riding home and you're driving your car and you're looking at your cell phone and you look up and you're off the road and your car hits a tree and it's the last thing you remember. And then, like, you don't know what's... You kind of wake up and you open your eyes and you hear someone yell and they run out of the room and your vision starts to clear and the doctor and the nurses come in and they say, you're awake. What do you remember? And you say, well, I remember this guy came to talk about some Indian tribe at our class and my car hit a tree. That was Monday. What day is it? And the doctor says, well, it's Thursday today. And you say, Thursday? You mean I wrecked 3 days ago? And he says, no, you wrecked 10 years ago. You've been in a coma for 10 years. Do you think you'd believe him? He just told you the truth. Do you think you'd believe him? I don't think you wouldn't be able to fathom that much time had passed. But now suppose he puts you in a wheelchair and he takes you down to the lobby and they give you a newspaper and you see in the newspaper that same date. Now you have two completely independent sources telling you the same information. Your trust that you're now being told the truth didn't just double, it went up an order of magnitude. That's what we have here. Remembrances and accounts and understandings of the true mighty acts of God from totally different cultures separated by time, space, and understanding. And it's true, but the world's completely blind to it. They never hear this sort of stuff. So I hope this kind of just helps. It's another tool in your toolbox to reach the world, and it's a great story. And by the way, all the talks I'm doing are part of that 18-part Rocks Cry Out series. And if you want to impact lives, buy those, watch them with your grandchildren, and then send them to another church and say, this would make a great Sunday school class. Because this is lecture number 2, and it's filmed on location with all sorts of animation and drone footage, and it's way better than the lecture I just gave you. But just put this stuff to use and change lives. And it's all to bring God's word back into the relevance of truth in people's lives. Thank you.